H.G. Morrison, Imperial War Museum, accession number 11585/3, reel 1.
Mr. Morrison, Reel 1.
Can you tell me how and when it was that you got this job of interrogating German prisoners, please?
Well, I can within reason, because it would be early 1941. At the beginning of the war, I was a staff sergeant in the City of London Special Constabulary. But I did not see how I could really further the war effort by being a policeman for the next few years, and therefore I volunteered for the Royal Air Force. When they eventually said that I could report to RAF Cardington to be issued with a uniform, I was also asked what job I had in civilian life. As you can imagine, the flight sergeant had never heard of such a job, as I was at that time a member of the Stock Exchange London and was a stock jobber, people they call today market makers. The result at Cardington was, you're going to number 2 technical training school. So I said, well, I hope I'm going to be on the engineering side, because I'm interested in particularly motor car engines in those days, as I like to take them to pieces and put them together again. However, I was told I would be dealing with airframes, which meant very little to me. The theoretical side of the course was, to me, perfectly simple, but the practical side, such as trying to file a piece of metal to within 1/1000th of an inch by eye, was totally impossible. And I said to the warrant officer in charge of the course, "Sir, I think I should give the whole thing up." To which he replied, "Nonsense. You will pass out top of this course." I'm afraid that by dint of what might be called a little cheating, I answered the questions for a colleague of mine, and as he was in peacetime an engineer with Rolls-Royce, he did my practical work. So between us, we did pass out pretty well. I then got posted to 5 Group Bomber Command at RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire, where I was allotted a Hampden aircraft, which I was supposed to keep flying. I was lucky enough to persuade the squadron adjutant that if I got near this aeroplane, it would never fly again. And I therefore spent several weeks in his office acting as his private clerk. By this time, my application for a commission had come through, and I went to Air Ministry, where I was interviewed for a few moments, and told that I was now a commissioned officer.
When would this have been, approximately?
This would have been, as far as I remember, early in 1942. Having gone away and got my officer's uniform, I was then summoned back to the Air Ministry, where a squadron leader asked me if I had any views on what I should do. And I said yes. As my German at the moment is pretty fluent, I thought I ought to interrogate prisoners of war. Nonsense, he said, you are going to technical intelligence. And I admitted that I had never heard of such a job. Well, he said, your records show that you have done a technical training course and that you speak German. And the fact is that most of the members of that small specialist department neither speak German nor do they know anything about aircraft construction. The reason for intelligence of any sort is to save the lives of our own people. And I hope that members of the public are not misled by recent stories about MI6 and the strange things which they do. Most intelligence really is, like police work, periods of intense activity followed by rather dull, humdrum, painstaking research. So within a week or two of joining this particular section, because it was hardly bigger than that, which was known in those days as Air Intelligence 1, and then G in bracket, AI1G. I was sent off with an officer who had been attached to it since the start, to a crash of a German aircraft in Yorkshire. It wasn't a terribly bad crash, so that he was able to show me a great deal in a short time. But my memory of it was that the whole thing stank of roast pig. And I then fell over something. Regrettably, it was not roast pig, it was one of the crew who'd been burnt to death in the crash and been thrown clear of the aircraft. But that is a memory which will stay with me all my life. Now, the exciting bits, I think one can say, are when you find a relatively small piece of metal, say not more than 6 inches long, which tells you exactly why the enemy aircraft had attacked a particular target. And this happened one day at Plymouth, or just outside Plymouth. But before telling you what that piece of metal was, perhaps I should explain that the department was based at Air Ministry, but we had throughout the country 7 officers who were known as outstation officers, and they were attached to maintenance units for the simple reason that Queen Marys, as they used to be called, which were large and long lorries capable of collecting the wreckage of an entire aeroplane, whether German or one of our own. And as we frequently wanted a lot of wreckage brought back for examination, a maintenance unit was the obvious place. Now, at Air Ministry, we relied upon those outstation officers to give us all the intelligence they could find. But there were occasions when, sitting at Air Ministry myself, I couldn't believe their reports. And I was inclined then to jump into my car to check the crash site myself. And this indeed happened at Plymouth. And after a very short time, I saw this so-called 6 inches of steel. And stamped on it, in German, were the words specially strengthened metal. That meant to me that it was a long wingspan aircraft, and it was designed to carry the latest of the German radio-controlled bombs, which were designed to sink battleships. So we have one useful piece of intelligence there.
Do you remember when this was, approximately?
I would think this could have been 1943, but I've forgotten the exact date. And the only way to discover it would be for me to go back to the public records office and try and dig out the actual report on that crash, which would naturally give the precise date. Anyway, what confused me was, how did the Germans know that there was a battleship to sink? So I drove to Plymouth Dockyards and asked to see the Admiral. He was not too pleased to speak to a relatively junior officer about security matters. But I insisted that if he did not believe that the Germans knew a battleship had come in the previous evening, he only had to walk out to my car and I would prove to him how I knew. Eventually he admitted that a battleship had in fact come in. And therefore, there was either a spy in the neighborhood or a leak from our own side. But that was one example, really, of a very small item proving more than just one thing. And the next thing, of course, that one looked for in the wreckage, which was spread over a very wide area, was the radio control for the bomb, as although we knew about it, we had never seen such an instrument. And this was not to be found anywhere. It was really great interest that we should find this control unit in case our radio experts could devise a countermeasure to put either the whole thing out of action or at least to divert the bomb. Now, there were a lot of troops based in that area, and knowing the magpie-like attraction of crashed aircraft and their instruments, I went to see the army commander and explained the importance of recovering this particular piece of equipment, which I suspected to be very small. Sure enough, in the end, we got it back, and a Professor R. V. Jones, who was to us known in those days as a boffin, was able to discover the exact wavelength which controlled the bomb on its path to destruction.
Did you pursue this question of the radio control bomb yourself much?
No, for the reason that wireless, as I always called any radio equipment in those days, was a closed book to me, but I knew that a Professor R. V. Jones, who operated at the Air Ministry, would get the answers which intelligence needed. And therefore, when the piece of equipment was eventually handed to me, I took it straight back to Air Ministry and it was handed over to the professor. The department, apart from having people like myself who actually examined aircraft on the ground, had another side to it, which we called the crystal gazers. And they received information from various sources in Europe about forthcoming German developments. And at one stage we heard about a new aircraft shorted to be in operation called a Heinkel 177. At that time, there was a well-respected night fighter pilot by the name of Max Aitken, and he sent a message to us saying that he had shot down a Heinkel 177 and it had crashed at the mouth of the Humber. I was therefore told to find this wreckage, and the only way to do so was to borrow a slow-flying aircraft and go up and down the Humber at a height of just a few hundred feet. Regrettably, the pilot flying me had forgotten the colours of the day, and we were meeting a somewhat hostile reception from the Royal Navy. So I abandoned the search. Fortunately, within a matter of a few weeks, a Heinkel 177 in fact crashed near Hindhead in Surrey, and I was able to confirm that our crystal gazer's information had been incredibly accurate.
Can you be more specific?
From the crystal gazer's point of view, they'd assumed it was to be the first four-engined bomber aircraft operational. And of course, I was able to prove them right with no difficulty whatsoever.
By what method did the crystal gazers get their intelligence, do you know?
Well, it really came from extremely brave slave workers, we used to call them, on the continent at that time. They would smuggle information out and somehow it would arrive with our tiny department. I would have just called them spies, but of course they were taking the most enormous risks to pass what was very secret information out through goodness knows how many channels to get it to us. And if I can perhaps jump a little bit over that, we knew about the V2 rocket, but we had no real detail at all. And one day when I decided that I deserved 48 hours off, I had no sooner got home than I was called back again, because there was a pile of paper about 2 feet high, which nobody could understand, sitting by my desk at the Air Ministry. These papers turned out to be the full working drawings of the V-2 rocket. And therefore, in a very short space of time, we knew its exact dimension, and also, of course, the weight of its warhead, which turned out to be approximately 1 ton and not 10 tons that people had been thinking about. Also, at the very time that we were going through these documents, Sir Winston Churchill was being told by his scientific advisers that it was totally impossible for the Germans to build a rocket that would reach this country.
So this information had come from the slave workers on the continent?
Yes. How it got onto my desk, don't ask me, but it did.
I think there was quite a lot of controversy at the time about what kind of fuel was propelling the V-2. Did that question of the fuel come into your own work at any time?
It only came in after D-Day, when, as my colleagues who accompanied the invasion moved through Europe, anything of the slightest technical intelligence interest found its way back to us at Air Ministry. And one day a jerry can arrived which was so heavy that I found great difficulty in picking it up. And this contained the hydrogen peroxide fuel, which was of very considerable interest, particularly to the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough. But I do not recollect whether there was any mention of the fuel in the working drawings which had arrived, and I suspect not, as they were purely technical drawings.
Where had the fuel come from?
That's a question that I cannot answer with any accuracy, except that one of our intelligence officers going through Europe had obviously come across a reserve of this fuel when they got into Holland, from where, of course, rockets were launched up until the Allies liberated Holland. How it got to me, I do not know, but that was not a spy. That was would have gone back through our ordinary lines of communication. Can't think of anything.
How actually heavy was this container of hydrogen peroxide?
Well, to tell you the truth, it never struck me that I would weigh it myself. I would have thought that compared with the same amount of petrol, it was at least 2.5 times heavier. In other words, a jerry can which might have weighed 50 pounds when full, seemed to me, for the struggle I had to lift it, must have weighed over 100 weight. One of the sensible things about intelligence is that unless you need to know a particular bit of information, you are not told. So when one day I was asked to go down and examined a crash near Uckfield in Surrey. I found some equipment which quite obviously was not German. But once again, it was what I called wireless. I therefore removed it from the wreckage, put it in my car, and took it back to our wireless expert, who immediately said, "That is G." At that time, G was our most secret form of navigational aid, and the fact that it was fitted to a German aircraft caused considerable dismay to our air defences and indeed to the chiefs of staff at Air Ministry. No, I'm sorry about that. Yes, sorry, I did not mean chiefs of staff at the Air Ministry. I was including all the services, and they met at the War Office. Indeed, such was the confusion caused that all the G wavelengths had to be altered as quickly as possible. And I remember 2 days later an air marshal ringing me up and saying, "Did you find that G set?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well done." And I was extremely cross, because if I had not found it, I would not have been doing my job properly.
Which year do you think that would have been?
I think it was probably the spring of 1943, because I remember it was an extremely pleasant day at Uckfield.